Good afternoon, members. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. The first order of business will be approval of the minutes dated February 9th. Representative Greiling moves approval of those minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, the first two bills on our agenda for today are going to be Representative Hancock. The chair will move. Representative Hancock, do you prefer to take up 1264 or 2109 first? Or don't you care?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll take up 1264 with your permission.
Okay, with that, the chair will move House File 1264 for possible inclusion in our bonding priorities list. Representative Hancock, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today we're requesting in 1264 a maximum effort school loan for District 38 to basically construct a cafeteria and kitchen that will serve both the high school and the middle school. I have with me Steve Wymore, who is the superintendent of District 38, who will give you a little more of the details. But this goes back to about 2002 and about a $40 million request for projects on the Red Lake School District. A couple of them have been approved, and we are here today to prioritize the spending. And I have been up to the school district a couple of times in my brief tenure here, and they are actually serving about 500 kids and people out of a couple kitchens that were built in the early 60s and actually set up salad bars in the hallways. So it's something that since 2002 has been needed to take attention to, and I think it's something that we need to address now. I think Superintendent Wymore would like to present a little bit more of the details concerning Red Lake.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now we know who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Wymore. I'm the superintendent at Red Lake Public Schools. With your permission, I'd like to read a prepared statement. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank Representative Pat Garofalo, the chairman of the House Education Finance Committee, and its members for your time to hear bills introduced by Representative Dave Hancock and Representative John Purcell, whom we also wish to thank. We believe that the provisions of House File 1264 and House File 2109 will strengthen the Red Lake Public School District. Red Lake Public Schools employs a staff of 306 employees on three separate sites. The district employees include 133 non-licensed employees, 173 licensed employees, 163 of whom are teachers. The district provides education to 1,321 students in grades K through 12, inclusive of an alternative learning program. There are 275 grades 6 through 8 middle school students and 272 9 through 12 high school students that will directly benefit from this facility enhancement. The Independent School District Number 38 Red Lake, with a 2010 U.S. Census population of 2,331 and comprising an area of 1,014 square miles, is located approximately 265 miles north of the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area along U.S. Trunk State Highway 1 and 89. It lies completely within the boundaries of the Red Lake Indian Reservation. The Red Lake Public Schools is a consolidated school district serving the communities of Red Lake, Red Bee, Panema, and Little Rock. The tragedy of March 21, 2005 continues to affect everyone who lives and works on the Red Lake Indian Reservation. However, the lessons learned from that tragedy have been utilized to provide one of the most caring and nurturing environments possible in a facility badly in need of improvement. The district has submitted a capital loan funding request every year since 2002, yet has only received appropriations twice that were approved by the governor. Both of these appropriations were only small percentages of the request. The original request in 2002 was for $40.1 million, which escalated in today's dollars would equal $68 million. These requests are for additions and improvements to the district facilities. Since the district does not have adequate bonding capacity due to the large amount of federal property in the district, requests must be made to the state of Minnesota for capital loans. While pieces of the project were approved in 2002 and 2005, the cost for the remainder of the project continues to grow. Over the past 4 years, the legislature has included appropriations for these projects only to have them vetoed by the governor. The Minnesota Department of Education requested $32,516,656 in funding this year through maximum effort capital loan programs to support the Red Lake Independent School District number 38 in bringing district facilities into educational standards compliance. The department goes on to point out that the measure commonly used to compare a school district's ability to raise funds through property taxes is the adjusted net tax capacity, or ANTC, per pupil unit. The Red Lake ANTC per fiscal year 2010 adjusted pupil unit was $6.33. Statewide, the median school district ANTC per adjusted pupil unit was $7,862. While the challenges our public parents, staff, and students face can be overwhelming, the Red Lake Public School continues to be an expedient for fostering the strong community that is the Red Lake Nation. I would ask the committee to support House File 1264 and House File 2109 and appropriate $5,491,000 and $7,989,000 respectively for Phase 1 and Phase 2 of the Red Lake Public School renovation and construction project that can be completed with these capital loans. This appropriation for Phase 1 would provide for the creation of a single lunchroom and kitchen for the entire high school and middle school, replacing two outdated facilities. It is crucial that we increase the efficiency of our food service because annually Red Lake Public Schools transfers general fund dollars to cover deficits in Fund 2 food service. The district-wide free and reduced lunch rate is 90%. As a result, every child in our district receives free breakfast, lunch, and in our elementary an afternoon snack. Over the last 2 years, Red Lake Public Schools have worked to reduce food service costs and the deficit from $862,607 to $368,523. We anticipate that by eliminating duplicated services that further cost containment can be realized through the addition of the cafeteria and service kitchen. With the demolition of the old elementary in Phase 2, district and student services, media center and technology labs, and PE locker rooms and support areas will be built and expanded. With these enhancements, the district can begin reinforcing the programs that have suffered as a result of inadequate facilities and send a message to the constituents of the Red Lake Public Schools that the state of Minnesota is willing to help the district provide high-quality education in a nurturing, caring, and safe environment where resources can be focused on raising student achievement for all of our children. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Superintendent. And Representative Hancock, did you have another testifier?
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, I didn't hear what you said.
Do you have an additional testifier? Or just someone with you to take questions?
Lee Meyer is here to answer some questions on the actual finances of it.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public testimony portion of this bill and move to member questions and comments. Any questions? Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the superintendent, has the Indian community taken a vote on the merits of the project?
Superintendent.
Mr. Chairman, there was an election this fall in November where the capital loan was approved by the general election.
Representative Anzels. Any additional questions or comments? Representative Greiland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hancock and testifiers. I just want to say that I I'm glad that the Department of Education made this their number one priority. I have always thought that this is a school district with no property wealth whatsoever. It should be our top priority for this committee, and I'm disappointed that the governor did not include it, and I hope that this committee can do better.
Any additional questions or comments from members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is a question for Mr. Strong. This would fall under maximum effort, correct? So could you help us understand a little bit better how that affects Red Lake? Because they'll never be able to repay their loan. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, this is under the maximum effort loan program. And that is technically a loan program, not a grant program. School districts, the reason the name is maximum effort is school districts are required to have a tax rate of the maximum effort allowed. And that tax rate then is used to repay the local share of bonds, and then when there's leftovers from that, to repay the state for the state bonds for the project. As the superintendent pointed out, Red Lake has virtually no taxable property within the school district boundaries. As a result, there's really no way for the district to raise any money by, regardless of the tax rate. There's simply no significant amount of money that's raised by the maximum effort rate. So as a result, for Red Lake, for all intents and purposes, it's a grant, not a loan, because there's no expectation that it will ever be repaid.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Stroman. To the superintendent, then, knowing this, and I know you already knew this anyway, is there an option two that can ever play in part from contribution from the casino revenue or any, you know, because you have more than one casino, I know. Is there any opportunity for that? Because I know on my Mille Lacs tribal land, you know, they build their own schools. Of course, they're not a public school district, but they are constantly improving their facilities. I mean, they're just fantastic, and you know they do all of that. So maybe with some help from the federal government. But do you have any other option? You know, a federal program, since you're a federally recognized Indian tribe, that could assist you,
Superintendent.
Now, Mr. Chairman, there are two other sources, as the representative pointed out. We do have casino revenue, but that money is used up for the operation of the tribe. There are subsidies that are paid to the members that live on the reservation, as well as all of the government operations of the Red Lake Band. In addition, we do receive federal impact aid as a federal trust land, but most of the money that is earmarked for construction is mainly in maintenance. It's a very minimal amount, and if I were to estimate that right now, I would guess about $130,000 is the max we receive annually for capital in the federal impact money.
Representative Erickson. Mr. Strong, the maximum rate right now, do you know what that is? Is it 30?
Mr. Chair, for existing loans, the maximum effort rate is just slightly above 32%. Last year's tax bill adjusted that up by 5 percentage points. And for new capital loans, the requirement in order to apply for the capital loan is at 40%.
Thank you. Any additional questions for members of the committee? Representative Hancock, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Only that we should probably move House File 2109 if we haven't done so.
Sure. With that, the Chair will renew his motion to have House File 1264 laid over for possible inclusion in our binding priorities. The Chair will then move House File 2109 for possible inclusion in our binding priorities. Representative Hancock to 2109.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think he's already addressed it, to be honest.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure it was included in the proposal.
Absolutely. Superintendent, did you have any comments regarding the you kind of covered it, did an overview, but the specific items contained in 2109?
Mr. Chairman, the only thing that I would add is that the addition that will be demolished is a 1950s addition to the school that was originally the elementary and subsequent additions to the high school. It contains asbestos and is not a healthy place. We still have unit vents that we use for indoor air quality and circulation. It's decrepit, outdated, and really is not a very conducive place for education. We need to replace that with the facilities to provide media center, locker rooms for PE, high school, or district offices and student services as well. It's very important that we move along with that.
Thank you. Any additional questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, the Chair will renew his motion to have House File 2109 laid over for our possible inclusion in our bonding priorities. So the Representative Hancock and our testifiers, thank you very much for making the trip down, and I hope to not see you again. I mean that in a positive way. Thank you. All right, the next item on our agenda is we have a presentation from some good folks from Utah regarding our permanent, regarding the permanent school fund. Representative Dietrich, did you wish to go up to the table with them, or do you want to stay in your table? It's up to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll stay here, and that will just give them a little more comfortable breathing room. No, thank you.
Sure.
No, it's overrated.
No, it's not. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Margaret Bird. I'm an employee of the State Office of Education and work as the Trustland observer of what goes on with our permanent fund as well as our lands. And I'm also a director of the Children's Land Alliance Supporting Schools, or CLASS. Go to the CLASS website at childrenslandalliance.org. And there is a portion on there on Minnesota. I've been invited here to talk about the school trust lands in Minnesota. The responsibility that's on your shoulders is a very sacred, irrevocable trustee responsibility. The fiduciary duty that accompanies every trust requires that you maintain a very high standard of respect for that trust and for the beneficiaries. And you'll see from that quote that it requires a punctilio of an honor the most sensitive. And that's the court's way of saying the highest level of behavior is expected down to every minute detail on that trust. The fiduciary duties that are imposed on the state of Minnesota include undivided loyalty. That requires that you as a state on the school trust lands, the 2.5 million acres of surface or 3.5 million acres of minerals, act in every way with undivided loyalty on that. That you're accountable for both the revenue that comes in and the expenses that go out on that trust. That the trust property must be made productive, because as you will recall, in the Enabling Act, it does require that these lands be granted for schools and for schools alone. A trustee is required not to commingle accounts, mix different trust accounts or trust and non-trust accounts, to obtain the best possible price in every transaction that occurs on the trust property, to keep the beneficiary, which in this case would be your schools in your state, to keep the beneficiary informed, and to preserve the trust. Because the wonderful thing that the founding fathers of our country saw when they granted these lands was it was a forever trust to support education in every state. When we began the process that you are now looking at in Utah, we had opposition from every major lobbying group within the state of Utah. And change is never easy. It's always something that our human nature resists change, because we know what the present is, but if there's change in the future, we don't know what that means. The opposition came from a ranching community that thought we were part of No Move by 92. It came from environmental groups that thought we were going to get in their way on wilderness designations, from the major user groups like petroleum, mining, Association of Counties. We were within the Department of Natural Resources. We did have a new director of the Department of Natural Resources that did support our breaking off because he thought it was a conflict. He was an attorney, felt like it was a conflict of interest. But the Department of Natural Resources, for the 17 years we worked toward a reform prior to that, had been very opposed. And there were some in education who were opposed because they simply didn't think the lands could make any money for schools. In a later slide, you'll see that it's not the case. The Utah legislature finally concluded, after 2 years of studying it with legislative committees and one with a citizens committee, concluded they couldn't change the past. We'd had 100 years of abuse in Utah in how we handle our school lands. But they did choose at that point to honor their fiduciary duty at the highest standard. And so in that honoring the standard, they broke the trust away from the Department of Natural Resources, which has a very important charge to responsibly protect and conserve the lands of the state. They broke the trust apart from that and set up the trust so that it would make money using a corporate model and made that an independent agency within state government. The results speak for themselves. Our permanent fund was the smallest in the nation when we began this quest, and it is now at $1.3 billion. You can see the increase there in that report. I'm pleased to let you know that now every major group in the state of Utah is very supportive of the school lands, and that money is going to every single school and making a huge difference in opportunities for our children. I wish I had time to share with you the kinds of responses we get from principals and teachers who, with tears in their eyes, tell us in these tight economic times they do not know what they would do without school trust helping them in their school. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kirby. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Kevin Carter, and I'm the director of Utah School Trust Lands Administration. And I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you today. I want to take a second and talk about the model that was in Utah prior to our change in 1994. At that time, trust land management was administered by an agency called the Division of State Lands and Forestry. We were the division within a Department of Natural Resources, somewhat analogous to your situation here in Minnesota now. At that time, the director of the agency served at the pleasure of the department head, but essentially he served at the pleasure of the governor. It was a politically appointed position. Trust revenues from the school trust management were used to subsidize a number of other departmental functions. The management focus of the agency was patterned after the federal government, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management type of management. And almost all of the employees of the agency were civil service or merit employees. In 1994, after the change, we were pulled out from the Department of Natural Resources and made a standalone entity. The director is appointed for a four-year term to provide him with some type of independence and security for difficult decisions that land managers have to make. We're entirely self-funded. We're funded from our revenues. No tax monies go to fund the operation. Almost all of our employees, except for the clerical, are now at-will employees following a business model. This shows an ownership map of the state of Utah to give you an idea of the scattered land base and intermixed land base that we're dealing with on this map. The yellow that you can see on there is federal land managed by the Bureau of Land Management. The light green is national forest. The dark green is wilderness areas and forest. The pink are national parks and national monuments, and the orange is Indian reservation. The little bit of white is private land. You can see mostly in northern Utah. And then the kind of pattern you see in the yellow of little teeny blue dots, those are 1 square mile sections that we manage, plus several larger blocks you can also see throughout the state. 3.5 million acres, plus an additional 1 million acres of mineral estate only. So that's what our management ownership pattern looks like, and you can see that we are continuously working with or at odds with our land management neighbors, either state or federal. One of the things that the new model has provided for is accountability. Every month we examine our progress on all of our different areas of business. We compare revenues versus what it's cost us to make them. The far right column runs a total for us so that we can determine that every program is running in the black. If any of those numbers approach one, then we know that the cost is approaching the proceeds and we need to do something about that. Net revenues by fiscal year have increased dramatically after the change. If you wanted to run this graph off to the left before 1994, that column would not change much in size. It was $10 to $15 million per year for decades. And then after the change in 1994, you can see what's happened to net revenues by year. For a number of years, above $100 million a year. We're kind of leveled off now at around 77, 75, thereabouts, as a function of low prices for natural gas and a contraction of the real estate market. In addition to our mandate to generate revenues from these lands, we feel like we have an obligation to be stewards of this land so that it maintains its productivity for the long term and not just to benefit today's beneficiaries. One of the main issues we deal with is cultural resources. You can see this world-famous panel, petroglyph panel, it's on a school section in central Utah. It's called the Great Hunt. If you look closely, you can see Native Americans with bows and arrows hunting desert bighorn sheep, in this case. And if you look at this far away picture, right in the center, you can see an oval there. That's the panel from the distance. On the left and right-hand sides of the picture, you can see red arrows that are pointing to a roadway that used to come right next to this panel. As a matter of fact, the roadway came so close that oversized mirrors on a pickup truck could scratch the panel as they drove by. It was that close. We worked with one of our lessees, an oil company. We rerouted the road away from the panel, barricaded that portion, and then built the protective structures and viewing structures around there to enhance the visiting public's experience there, but also protect the resource. Other resources that we deal with are plant and animal species, fundamentally those that are on the federal endangered species list. Plants on the endangered species list are not protected by the Endangered Species Act on non-federal lands. So plants on state land or trust land or private land are not protected. Animals, however, it doesn't matter who the landowner is. If you have an endangered animal species on your private property, you have just acquired a wonderful opportunity for an intimate experience with your federal government. We've recognized that we are not the ultimate managers of lands that have this type of habitat. And our goal is to move these out of our ownership into federal ownership or the ownership of an entity such as the Nature Conservancy, who does have those kind of obligations and opportunities. But while we're waiting for that to happen, we are maintaining this habitat and protecting it. And we don't see that as a conflict with a full-bore trust management fiduciary duty. In fact, there are some opportunities to use the presence of endangered species to enhance revenues. For example, the Utah prairie dog that you see on the screen right here, a federally listed species that occurs on private and trust land in southwestern Utah. And they enjoy lawns, graveyards, golf courses, any place where the overstory has been removed so that they can keep an eye out for raptors, which is their main predator. Unfortunately, they've moved into people's backyards, and when they're there, you can't mow the lawn, you can't do anything that will disturb them. And so in order to help facilitate the survival of this species, we have located a piece of trust land away from urban areas, dedicated it for prairie dogs, and then make it available for translocating these animals from places where it doesn't make sense for them to be, where they're at danger and they're actually, frankly, they're a risk to the public because they carry sylvatic plague, but also where they can be safe. And so we make money by doing this by selling credits. You purchase a credit to translocate your prairie dog onto this preserve that we have, and it protects the dog, it creates more of the species, and allows us to generate revenue from this situation. So it's been a good thing for us. We have a lot of sensitive land in Utah. As you can see by the picture of this arch, this is Corona Arch, which is on trust lands. We are not the final owner of a piece of property like this. We can protect it while it's in our ownership, but we need to get it into some other ownership, and that's fulfilling our mandate. This is, you don't get a perspective of this, of the size of this thing, until you realize that this little dark spot right there, those are two people sitting underneath that arch. It's huge. As a matter of fact, there's pictures in Moab of an airplane flying through this arch. So it is a big arch. And you might think that there is nothing you could do with a piece of property like this except enjoy the view of it. And you would be wrong, because there's other things you can do.
Chairman Garoppolo?
So if any of you want to take a swing off the arch, come on out and we'll facilitate it, and you can have your chance.
Sounds like we got a committee road trip coming up.
Yeah. I guess in closing, since the inception of the Trust Lands Administration in 1994, we've been responsible for over 550,000 acres of preservation in Utah, and more than any conservation or preservation group combined in the state. So in addition to our mandate to use these lands to generate money for the schools, we are also a responsible land steward. And be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. It was Ms. Beard and Mr. Cart, correct?
Bird.
A couple of quick questions. Number one, obviously the change in oversight took place. What were things that were taking place under the old structure that stopped taking place, and what are the things that started taking place at that point? Can you give us some examples of why? I mean, obviously, just changing the oversight in and of itself wasn't successful. There was a change in behavior. Can you give us some examples of those behaviors?
I could tell you that everything that could go wrong was going wrong at the time that we made the changes. We had the smallest permanent fund in the nation. We charged the least amount of money in the nation for grazing on our school lands. We had major problems where we had leases out there for coal that said you can either pay 15 cents a ton or 8% of the prevailing rate, which would have been almost $3, and we were charging 15 cents a ton. We had oil and gas leases where we simply weren't keeping track of who had what lease and what was owed, and we had royalties not being paid and then companies going bankrupt and not going to the bankruptcy court to receive the money. I did research on school lands for about 17 years before I finally convinced people it was broken, it was unfixable. And then we started about a five-year process to make the change until we made it in 94. But everything that could go wrong was going wrong. That became a strong motivator when our legislators heard how badly managed it was. They were furious. We were denying children $1 million worth of books a year in order to purchase foresters in the forestry section. So you name it, we were doing it poorly. We managed our permanent fund for liquidity, even though it was supposed to be a permanent fund. You know, you could go down and make a better investment than they were making with $18 million. So I can't tell you one thing. There wasn't one thing I investigated that was run right in 17 years of research.
Mr. Carter, do you have anything else to add on that?
No.
Okay. In terms of the resources that you utilize to maximize this, obviously you appoint a director. In Minnesota, we don't, as far as I know, we have any oil and gas resources here, but it's a lot of mining and forestry. How do they, short of appointing somebody who's an expert in all these things, what resources are you able to utilize to find out where the best opportunities are for maximizing revenue or transferring those things out?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What we have done since the creation is that we have gone into the private market and hired away people to work with the agency who have that expertise. So I have a person in my oil and gas section that used to work for an oil distributor and developer, and she knows where the resources are at, what companies we need to be dealing with, and how we can glean the most revenue from those lands. For hard rock mining, which is something that you have, I hired away an individual from a local mining company, Rio Tinto, which is an international mining company, now the parent of Kennecott. Yeah, so we hired away a person from them to manage our mining. We do copper, coal, potash, phosphate. Those are the typical minerals that we're mining, and sand and gravel. And then the same thing for real estate development. I hired a person away from a private realty company to come in and run those programs, and they know, they have ties and contacts with the industry still. And that's how it's helped us to be in the right place at the right time.
Any additions to that?
Well, I think one of the other things that's been very important has been our Board of Trustees are people that not only are known as leaders in their field in real estate, non-renewable resources, and renewable resources, but they're also people who are of the highest integrity. So I have had people that have served on that board. There was one man that was the head for the nation of the ethics for the U.S. Bar Association, American Bar Association. And he said to me, you know, I've had a life full of service, and he has served in every responsible position you can name in the state of Utah. And he said, of all the service I've ever performed, the thing that meant the most to me was serving on that Board of Trustees. And so I believe that by having that high caliber, it attracts others with high caliber. And it is amazing the direction and policy that they set for the agency, because they really know these industries so well, that then has generated so much money for our schools and made such a tremendous difference. I mean, I would love to have an investment I could say that 20 years ago it made that kind of increase from $18 million to $1.3 billion in that length of time. So it's been a huge increase to the schools, and it's an increase that's really mattered.
And are either of you familiar with the governance structure we use in Minnesota for our permanent school funds?
I'm familiar that you have a Department of Natural Resources that manages all of your natural resources, all of your state lands, including trust lands.
And a permanent school fund advisory committee that provides direction.
Do you have any thoughts on that in terms of having the current structure where DNR?
Well, they just provide recommendations, don't they? The permanent school, they're just advisory versus actually hiring and firing the person who manages their lands. I served on the land board in the old Department of Natural Resources. I served a term on that land board, and it was a great frustration to me because we kept trying to tell the elephant to go that way. But the elephant for 100 years had gone that way, and they knew they were going to outlast, you know, any of us on the board, so they kept going that way.
He's a donkey instead of an elephant.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that to be political.
Elephants are very loyal.
I used to say dinosaur, but okay.
One of the things that I would respond to that, Mr. Chairman, is that I have been doing this for 30 years, and for 13 years it was with an agency that was similar to what you have in Minnesota now, and then for 17 years with a new agency. In those 13 years, we went through five directors. And so what the message was to me is that it is difficult, if not impossible, for someone to be within a Department of Natural Resources with all of the mandates that it has, focus on the trust mandate, and keep his job.
Well put. Well put. Questions from members of the committee. Representative Breiner and then Ansels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I really appreciated your presentation and the ways in which you showed you recognized the capacity of different types of lands that are in your trust. And, you know, what we normally think maybe of as money-making is too narrow a frame. But you must, in the course of your work, have run into conflict between the potential of some of your land to produce revenue and your responsibilities for environmental stewardship. And I'm wondering what some examples of that were and how you balance that. It sounds like you have a board that has a very sophisticated level of knowledge in all these areas and probably worked in a collaborative way, but I just would like you to speak to that, because that's some of the concerns I hear about when the focus is on the revenue-producing aspects of the land. How do you balance that with stewardship?
The focus is always on the preservation of the trust and on revenue production for current generations and future generations. If we were to take that wonderful arch and grind it up for gravel, it would be a lot of gravel. It would be a lot of money. But it would not be perhaps the best use of that into the future. A group like the Nature Conservancy could come in. They purchased Castleton Towers. We had a Have you seen the ad with Michael Jordan on the top where he's way up high in the air and they kind of swoop around him and he's dunking the ball? He's on top of a mesa, on top of a or on top of a Castleton Towers in Utah, outside of Moab. When he's up there doing that, they took the car up and put it up on top with the helicopters. But on something like Castleton Towers, we had a developer that said, "Well, make a lot of money on a development right there." There was concern about that because it's a very special landmark in the state of Utah, and so instead it was sold to a conservation group. So it doesn't have to be conflict. It can be partnerships where we work together, do what's best for the children, and when it's not something that should be ours, we get it into other hands.
Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how did you learn to do your job? I mean, it's a very, what you're representing to me is a tremendously sophisticated balance. I don't see this often in an organization, public or private.
He does all the balancing. They call me the junkyard dog. And so what I am is I'm the irritant out there that says, remember the children. Have undivided loyalty. If he's getting inordinate pressure from some individuals to do something that might make us some land, but they want a special deal, so they want a little better than the marketplace deal, then I provide a shield for the director so he can say, you know, I'd love to be able to do that for you, but my beneficiaries would never allow that. So I think it is important to have that counterbalance. It's important to have a trustee with undivided loyalty, but it's also important to have a beneficiary paying attention and looking out for the best interests of the children. I did tell Kevin he couldn't say this on this this trip, but he frequently refers to the beneficiaries as a two-edged sword, and that's because on the one hand we're out there with the sword defending what he's doing when we believe it's right. But if we don't agree with him on something he's doing, he gets the other edge of the sword. Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. Representative Ryder, any other questions?
Yes, thank you.
Representative Amzels, then Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think and I hope we can all agree that the outcome that we strive for is to maximize revenue for public school kids off school trust fund lands, the overwhelming majority of which come from three counties, St. Louis, Cooch, and Itasca. And when you balance what we all want as the outcome, I think all of us need to have our eyes wide open as to how it is in the real world we're going to provide more trust fund dollars to educating our kids. You should know that Rio Tinto is a multinational copper nickel mining company. You should know that the two sources of additional revenue at the end of the day are mining and logging, mining and forestry, digging holes in the earth, extracting huge quantities of overburden in order to realize small trace amounts of extremely valuable mineral resources. And you should know that there will be a cost to this, and you should know that merely rearranging the administrative and bureaucratic system or systems will not result in the outcome we all want magically. So what I'm saying is this legislature and the people of Minnesota have some real, real hard choices to make. And we're running out of time. So I hope you think of them.
Representative Ansells, you've got a unique perspective on this because you represent that area, but what year are we in now of the permitting of non-ferrous mines up in the range? How long have they been out just in this, just in the permitting side of it?
Mr. Chair, the permitting of a non-ferrous mining operation in the periphery of the pristine Boundary Waters Canoe area, which is where this would take place, is in its sixth year of permitting.
So regardless of it, I mean, this is a separate issue outside of this, but I think you were alluding to this, is that there are forces and decisions outside of our committee's jurisdiction, but certainly regardless of what people's opinions are on that, over a half a decade to not reach a decision, it points out that there's other problems.
Correct.
So Representative Ward, and then Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to piggyback off of a couple comments by Representative Breinert and Representative Zelk, and you know, I was at the press conference yesterday, and a number of us supporting the movement with Representative O'Driscoll and Senator Representative Dietrich, help me, Cruz. I should know him; he's my size. well, so is Rukavina, but I mean, there was the three of us there. And a few little trees amongst taller trees is what it was, speaking of forestry. Anyhow, thank you for that, Representative Garofalo. Anyhow, you know, I the focus, as Representative Van Zelk said, and Representative O'Driscoll and Senator Cruz and Representative Rick Vina and Representative Dietrich, number of people that have talked about school trust lands have always reminded us that the focus needs to be our children, and that's what the school trust lands were set up for, and revenue for that. And then Representative, I think, Rukavina, I can't remember which one it was, pointed out that the a conflict of interest with, you know, with the administration administrating the school trust lands along with being in charge of them is difficult at best. And I think Representative Dietrich, you were called the Wonder Woman yesterday, the Superwoman, and you truly have been remarkable in this effort. And I think you pointed out that you know, there's been $250 million lost with the lack of proper in investment over the last several years with that. And that, you know, that's really critical for our schools right now. I mean, for our school children, period. And I got an email today from a former DNR employee that said something like, just, Representative Zells, this is in reference to you, just kind of switching the management status isn't going to necessarily change things, and might, in fact, rather than a long-term kind of investment that we want to have, maybe shorten that investment time, as you also suggested. But we are where we are right now, and we need to do what we need to do to make sure that the resources, especially for our school children, are there. And this is one of the ways. When we in the state of Minnesota, you know, have not funded our education system, you know, with inflation increases lacking 13% over the last decade, you know, we're all grabbing for those pennies in the couches. And this happens to be trees and ore and mine that we're trying to grab for. You know, I also visited with a DNR official yesterday that said, we have a new commissioner that is aware of the problem and wants to be proactive, and just let's give him a little bit more time to make sure that, you know, we're doing this right. And my response was, as Representative Rukavina stated, nobody's listened to me for 26 years, and we've been trying to fix this for 26 years. And I'm not sure what Commissioner Landwehr is doing with this or whatever, But I really applaud Representative O'Driscoll and Senator Cruz and all of the folks that are trying to move forward on this. And I guess my question to you folks, and it's really difficult, but you know the minister. I remember you were here, I think, 2 years ago, if I remember correctly, to the education and finance, and that time it really opened my eyes, and you know I jumped all in at that point, and I'm glad I'm all in. And you know the Minnesota situation, and can you kind of just give us your opinion of where we are versus where we can be? You understand what I'm saying here?
Yes.
You've done that to some extent, but I would like you to kind of really get at the root here, if you can, if you wouldn't mind.
Did you do the test first?
If you want me to get really at the root of this, I don't know that you could do any worse than what I've seen in data, which is you had 11 years at one point where you didn't put one penny of the forestry income into the permanent fund. Mm-hmm. The trust belonged to the children, and there was no benefit to the children at all during those 11 years. I believe in 2010 was the year you made $10 million from forestry and only deposited about $100,000 of that in the permanent fund. You have nowhere to go but up at this point. I'm a strong believer, and I believe this in Utah too, and sometimes it's scary when you first start out, but I'm a strong believer when you own 2.5 million acres, you ought to be able to trade those for other lands that could be productive. You ought to be able to develop some of those lands. You ought to be making more money than what you're currently putting in your permanent fund, because we're talking about what goes in the permanent fund is your net revenue after they have certified certain costs in the forestry. And I think you can do better with 2.5 million surface acres and 3.5 million mineral acres. You ought to be able to put more than $10 million a year into your permanent fund. Your fund is growing at a very slow rate. You were, in 1920, you had the second largest permanent fund in the nation. The only ones ahead of you were Texas, and that's because they came in as an independent nation and granted themselves land, so they were very generous in their grant. And you're now in the very toward the bottom of the pile, way below half.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And thank you for your honest and frankness on this. And not just one more question, then kind of, we can do that in a long-term sustaining way.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Other states are doing it. Idaho has certified forests, and they don't spend more than 30% in the management of their forest.
Yeah, I think my response to the question would be that this is a real deja vu thing for me, because I was hearing these very hesitations and resistance to change in 1994 in Utah. And the message that I heard so often back there from our DNR was that this won't make any difference. Pulling us out won't make any difference. It's not the managers that are the problem. That was the message.
Last question goes to Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I won't take quite as long as my mate here, but anyway, I heard you this morning. You do a great job with your presentation, and thank you for coming. I just had a quick question. You talked about hiring people away from industry, the oil company or gas companies, to run your programs the way they should be run. Do you have any wage restraints in terms of how much you can pay these people? Is a state agency, or are you quasi-independent? How do you handle attracting top-quality people?
We are quasi-independent, and we do have a lot more flexibility in the salaries that we can pay. One of the things that makes that possible is that we're self-funded. And so, we are outside of the traditional personnel department regulations in many ways. And also, we got that way because our people are at will instead of traditional merit employees. You know, they serve at the pleasure of the director in most of their cases, and they perform, and they earn the money that we pay them, or they don't and they find another job.
Representative Anderson? Representative Dietrich, I was wrong. You get the last guy.
Yeah, and I really don't have a question. I would just like to point out, make a couple comments about some of the handouts that are in your packet, because they are not self-explanatory a lot of times. First of all is, I just want to remind everybody when they start thinking about school trust lands and the sensitivity of them, it is very difficult to get people to accept change. And it was in 2008 that we actually passed a bill that said we will no longer take the school trust land money that we give to the schools and then subtract it out of the general fund. When we passed that bill on the House, somebody ran over to me and said, congratulations, we have never passed a bill that says school trust lands in the title before. So just know how difficult this is and why is it difficult. Because there are many people who want to hang on to what they have. So this chart, though, does help you see that. And it also tells you the flow of money for school trust lands. And let me tell you, it is much more complicated than what that chart alludes to. One of the issues, though, is that we allow the Department of Natural Resources to deduct their expenses off of the revenue with basically very little oversight. And they do it at the end of the year. You can't question it at the end of the year. You can't challenge it at the end of the year. It is truly an expenditure. And if you look at this chart right here, it gives you an example of the type of information we get at the advisory committee. Now, remember, as Ms. Bird mentioned, we are only an advisory committee. We give advice, and then the Department of Natural Resources takes their action. And if you look at the forestry management, those expenses, this is in the spreadsheet down at the bottom, those expenses have gone up 125% in the last 5 years in 2009. If you look at the administration costs, they have gone up 325% in the last 5 years. Granted, the industry has tanked, but they have still been selling about the same amount of timber on our school trust lands and getting somewhere in the same range of revenue. It gets to be about $10 million each of those years, but their expenses are what are skyrocketing. And there is not a business in the United States that could sustain those types of increases and still be in business. The last thing that I want to point out to you and close with is Ms. Bird did an excellent job of talking about the duties of a trustee. When you stand up on the House floor and you take that oath of office, you are a trustee because you are making major decisions on the trust, whether you like it or not. You are there to uphold the Constitution, which very clearly outlines our duties in regards to trust lands, along with the Enabling Act, and along with the anybody else who makes major decisions, basically SBI and the DNR. And these are the duties of a trustee. And I go through this chart, and I contend that the DNR violates about half of these on just going through it on a simplified manner. And then lastly, I just want to point out that yesterday at the press conference, somebody asked me a question, how did I even get interested in this? And I have to blame Representative Greiling. So, and since she's leaving, I think we can do that. She had the fortitude to ask for a group of people who wanted to work on school trust lands. Actually, the chair, Groplow, and I were on that committee, and I think we basically worked on it alone. And it was his great advice on eliminating the subtraction that it actually got done. And so the two chairs here have done a remarkable job of supporting what we have tried to do. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Representative Brown, we got one more minute, and then we have to let our testifiers go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to speak, but when Representative Dietrich made that very nice comment, and I'll take the credit for all of your work.
Good.
And you've arrived, because now we have majority party members, you know, working on the bills as well, and that's the highest form of compliment. But I just want to say to the members for the institutional memory here on the school trust land funds, as long as I'm leaving, just so all the new people know this too, one of the ways I got interested in having this issue worked on is when the first year I was the chair, I got called into the office of a member senior to myself, and in the office was another member senior to myself, and they were there with a staff person. They had permission from the speaker, and I was in the majority at the time, and they took money that they needed for something in another committee from the school trust lands. I mean, it was not the money that's being stripped off the top by the DNR for operations. It was just plain a taking of money that should have gone to the schools. And it wasn't because we hadn't yet passed Representative Dietrich's bill in 2010, it didn't actually make a cut to the schools because it just went into this amorphous general fund. But I'm a very strong environmentalist, and I've had to wrestle with the same questions that Representative Breinert brought up, and so I'm so glad for our experts here that you have sage wisdom and you've worked those things out, because that's very important to me. But I saw that we needed a Representative Dietrich junkyard dog here in Minnesota to make sure no one ever came into Chair Garofalo's office or anyone else's and just plain needed money for a budget item somewhere else and took it from the school trust lands money as if no one would notice or care.
And to our testifiers, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. We understand that you have to go over to the Senate now, so good luck over there.
Thank
you very much for traveling up here and sharing with us the success you've had in Utah, and I hope that in a couple of years we can replicate that success here in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, members, first of all, my Valentine gave me some candy this morning, so I'm going to pass it around if you want to grab some quick. Grab one. The next bill on the agenda is House File 2078, Representative Dietrich. And Representative Dietrich, as you're approaching the table, we're going to have Mr. Strom do an overview of this. That's okay. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House File 2078 has to do with the non-public equal aid. That's an aid that's been in existence since 1975. It has three parts to it. It reimburses non-public schools for certain costs for textbooks, health services, and guidance and counseling activities. The amount of the reimbursement is set at the school district average spending on those items. This bill, House File 2078, deals with one part of that formula with the non-public pupil aid textbook portion. For the current year, the reimbursement rate is about $81.40 for textbooks. Non-public schools apply through a process to get reimbursement essentially for those expenditures. This bill doesn't change the formula for calculating the aid amount, but does broaden the use of the things that the aid can be spent on by the non-public school. Members may remember that 2 years ago we slightly broadened the definition to include certain electronic workbooks, essentially. This bill, however, expands that use significantly and includes software, hardware, other educational technology in the definition of those things that the non-public school can spend the state aid on.
Thank you. Representative Dietrich, did you wish to... Representative Dietrich moves that House File 2778 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. So Representative Dietrich...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to point out that the reason I brought this bill forward is because I have a constituent, and he is on the board of Totino Grace High School, and he has seen some of the language here restrictive of what they can do in regards to delivering a high-quality education to their students. And so I invited him here to come and testify, but he was not able to come, so I asked him just to write a paragraph quickly as to why he supports this bill. And so I would just like to, I will quickly read it to you. As our staff and board look to the future at Totino Grace, we realize that technology must play a significant role if we are to meet either of these two objectives of high quality education and efficient delivery. He says, by allowing our institutions to use dollars allocated for books to be used for more advanced technological learning, we are stepping that much closer to reaching our objectives. Providing the required hardware and software will do more than simply replace books. It will open up an entirely new world of educational advancement to both the staff and the student by expanding resources available through electronic medium. We constantly ask of our educators to perform better, yet seldom provide up-to-date resources to allow them to advance. This is a simple change. It has virtually no economic impact to the current funding. Instead, will allow our schools to advance their educational services to meet ever-increasing educational demands. So I just wanted to read that from him. I know that the department has some concerns about this as in regards to the separation of church and state. And so I would ask that if they do, that the department provide some language that would provide some security that the materials are not used for religious purposes. But I would say in an electronic world that becomes a little bit more fuzzy. There is nothing actually even preventing a child in the public school to go in the media center and possibly look at religious type materials. So, and I guess I would hope that we actually encourage them to explore things like that in their academic endeavors.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. Does that conclude your presentation?
Yes.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public testimony portion of our bill and move to comments or questions from members of the committee. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dietrich, I think you have a good bill. I have a question perhaps for counsel here, just because I don't know all the background here. Are school districts required to provide these services at a cost over what the reimbursement is from the state? I'm not sure I'm asking it that right way, but what I'm getting at is, do we have situations where a school district is spending $10 more per unit than what the state is going to reimburse, or is it capped at the actual expense capped at the statewide average?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Mariani, the actual expense is capped, so a district is not required to provide any more than what it receives in the non-public aid.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Any closing comments, Representative Dietrich?
No, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Representative Dietrich renews her motion that House File 2078 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Dietrich.
Thank you.
Members, the two next items on our bill are Representative Dietrich and I have two bills that are relatively similar. I think we'll start off with the weak bill, 2036, the Garofalo bill. And members, we're not going to be voting on either 2036 or 2075. So the chair will move House File 2036 for possible inclusion in our possible inclusion in a later bill. And Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow, if you could just please highlight this bill, and if you want simultaneously to also cover the difference, basically cover my bill and then what Representative Dietrich's bill does. And looks like you have a testifier with you, too, Representative Dietrich.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, in the spirit of bipartisanship and working together, he is going to testify in favor of both bills.
Fantastic. Chair likes that. So actually, why don't we, while Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow are getting together, why don't we take a testimony from your testifier. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Patrick Plant, and I'm the Chief Technology and Information Officer of the Anoka Hennepin School District, and I appreciate that you and the member of the Education Finance Committee have allowed me to testify this afternoon. In addition to the school district, I'm also representing MEMO, which is the State Technology Media Organization, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Educational Technology Task Force, which is a partnership of school districts, consortia, and the Department of Education. We appreciate both Chair Garofalo and Representative Dietrich's leadership on this important issue and bringing these bills forward. The bills, House Files 2036 and 2075, address the progressively and more urgent need for a systemic approach to funding school and classroom technology and higher bandwidth networks. The unstable and inconsistent nature of technology funding for PK-12 education in Minnesota has made effective planning, business management, and delivery of today's learning opportunities for students extremely difficult and inequitable. So why our school district is promoting a categorical fund, I'd like to speak to for a minute. And as you perhaps don't commonly have school districts promoting categorical funding, but in this case, my superintendent, our CFO, and I do support a categorical funding in that it's needed to be both effective at the state and local level for planning to meet state requirements. And in doing that, we need to have a uniform funding base for technology required for state requirements for all school districts. We see the permanent school fund and our school trust land funds as being a viable source for that, and also in a source that appears to have some good revenue growth potential for the future needs as well. And just to kind of get into a specific example of funding and revenue use for technology in a school district, in your materials, I placed a copy of existing funding and revenue use for student access, which is the largest cost area for schools, of course, from our 2012-2016 school board approved technology plan. And in that chart, what you're going to see is that we've continued to maximize on using every revenue source that we have available to us, if that's building or district capital, which has not changed over the last few years, federal or state sources that are available through various granting mechanisms. And our district was one that was fortunate to have our voters approve a technology levy this last fall, which also then gave us $80 a student, or you'll see is 33% now of our overall revenue for funding technology for student and teacher use in the school district. The biggest missing piece of the pie here is the 11% that you see at the bottom, and that is we don't currently have any kind of predictable ongoing source to pay for state-mandated online testing or state reporting that inherently requires infrastructure within the schools for both student test-taking and to conduct the tests themselves. The 11% there that you see in this funding pie does, in essence, amount to approximately $28 per student. And that's a consistent need for all school districts in the state. Second in your packet is another document that outlines student skill development. And it's a document entitled The Framework for 21st Century Learning from the 21st Century Partnership, which is a nonprofit and private organization devoted towards supporting student skill development. And you'll see a graphic on the front of the document that represents the four key skill areas that students need to develop knowledge, skills, expertise in for both success in school today and future success in higher education and the workplace. On the back, it further details the areas, but there are four primary categories of core subject areas and 21st century themes: learning and innovation skills, information, media, and technology literacy skills, and life and career skills. And finally, I'd just like to say that it's increasingly alarming for the state of Minnesota that we're already in the second decade of the 21st century, but yet have no plan in place to ensure that school districts and students have the resources in place to both meet these testing requirements and develop the skills they need to be successful and effective in life. With that, again, I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Crown and Mr. Stroh, the difference between the two bills is that 2036 takes the increment above $28 per pupil and puts it into this fund, whereas the Dietrich bill just takes the entire lot. Is that correct? Any other things that carry attention? The only reason I'm asking is that on line 1.7 of the Dietrich bill, it says a charter school or school district, and then looks like there's a a little bit of a definitional change there, whereas on lines 1.11 and 1.12, now there's different wording there. Does that matter at all?
No, Mr. Chair, it does not matter, and the same, essentially same kinds of technological things. As to the charter schools, remember the bill that passed last year that shifts the funding to the adjusted student count redefined charter schools as a type of school district, because the Constitution requires that the permanent school fund money go to school districts.
Gotcha. So, this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns about the bills? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion on this bill and both bills, and we'll open up for member comments or questions. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just clear up for me the $28 figure? As the testifier said, it comes from the 11% assumed obligation. And I'm assuming that this is the Anoka Hennepin. Okay, so that $28 figure, does that change statewide depending upon your district and what?
No, Representative Ward, the $28 figure is called, you can let Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom answer this, but the $28 figure is what's currently being given to school districts. And so there's an argument out there that would say you're taking general fund resources for school districts and transferring it to technology. An argument out there would say that let school districts keep that money, but now the growth in this fund is the only portion that goes to technology. Whereas Representative Dietrich's bill, and she can characterize the bill herself, it takes that $28 they're currently getting and puts it into technology as well.
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich, is that correct?
Fair. Yep.
Mr. Strong, Mr. Crow? Yeah. Any other questions or comments, Representative Reiner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the testifier did a good job of trying to answer this question, but having spent 12 years on a school board and coming from a district that has had a technology referendum in place for well over a decade, I found myself a little bit offended by the idea that we would tell school districts how they had to use this money. Not that there isn't a great argument for the growth capacity and the need for technology. Nevertheless, in the coming budget, you know, any given school district might make the argument that they planned ahead and they're meeting their technology costs and there's something else they need that money for. So why is this, are we micromanaging here?
Not to the testifier, Representative Dietrich.
Mr. Chair, Representative, speak on that really to both comments that were made by both representatives. The reason that Anoka Hennepin is promoting that it be categorical is really to get at cost efficiencies and planning statewide. And so, you know, for example, this is, it does specifically relate to the Anoka Hennepin funding chart, the $28. And in essence, we did not think that asking our local voters to pay for state mandated online testing or state reporting, it was appropriate to ask them for that. And we did hope that at some point the legislature would fund those initiatives. The reason, again, for believing that for all school districts there's a common interest in wanting it to be categorical is to ensure that we can get best cost leveraging when we're purchasing student testing computers, or so that we can do common planning as a state working with the department, knowing there's a revenue source that's coming related to that testing. So it's really in the spirit of collaboration of districts with the state that we are encouraging the categorical.
Representative Brenner?
That's very satisfactory.
Representative Dietrich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Brenner. That's why in my definition of technology, the five different options, we tried to make it very broad. And there are some that have said it's too broad, that people could, you know, outgame the system. But we tried to make it very, very broad so that those people who do have technology bonds or levies in place, bonds in place, that they weren't supplanting that. Or, yeah.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair will renew his motion to have House File 2036 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. And then Representative Dietrich moves to have House File 2075 also laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. And this concludes Denise Dietrich Day in the Education Finance Committee. Representative Dietrich, any other comments?
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to make one final comment, and thank you for the opportunity today. We got to talk about my two favorite subjects, school trust lands and technology. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any closing comments for members of the committee? Members, we are adjourned. Thank you.